Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on December 4th, so please mark your calendars. And again, I want to thank you for joining us this election day. Hopefully everyone's getting out there and making their voices heard. So let's go ahead and get started with this month's call. I want to explain to, for those of you who are new on this call, how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants that we have on today, what we do is we ask people to submit their questions online ahead of time. A lot of you have responded, and we are going to go through those questions. Also, we do open up the forum usually towards the end of the call. To those of you who are online now and did not get a chance to submit them via email, so a couple options there. You can either type in your question in the questions box, and I will read it aloud, or you can just simply enter your name. I will call on you, unmute you, and let you speak to us live. Completely your choice. All right, so now let's go ahead and begin with the introduction of our speaker today. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute's legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. So, ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, and be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesday of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to visit our website at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. On the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. Again, if you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. So we're going to go ahead and jump right in to the questions that were submitted prior to today's call. As a reminder, the VIP members who have signed up for a VIP membership package online will get priority. So the first round of questions here were submitted directly from members. So let's go ahead and start with Cliff. Cliff is a CPA, and Cliff is asking, a taxpayer, files 2014 S-Corp paper tax return by extended due date of 9/15 of 2015. Via certified receipt as proof of filing for both filing dates, no return receipt requested. IRS issues late filing penalty of approximately $1,200. Challenging the S-Corp extension was filed late, therefore tax return was 6 months late. Taxpayer ignores the notices, IRS eventually levies bank account and takes money on October 15th of 2016. So Cliff's questions are, is filing receipt sufficient enough for proof of filing without return receipt requested? IRS should be recording certified number in database in addition to postmark date as well as actual date received. Question number two, if number one is not sufficient, is taxpayer barred from recovering the money today by statute of limitations of 2 years from the date of payment? And question number three is, if scenario was slightly different and notice was for assessment of personal income tax, not just solely a penalty, does this change application of statute of limitations?
Okay, so I'll answer all the questions first. A filing receipt sufficient for proof of filing? And the answer is yes. So if you file something, let's say you're going to mail it certified mail and you have a tracking number, you can track it and see when it was delivered. Also, by tracking it, it will show when the post office received it. So because of the mailbox rule that it has to be, you know, postmarked by a certain date, then you've established that it's been postmarked by that date, and you've also established that it's been delivered on a certain date. So you really don't need return receipt. As long as you have a tracking number, just track it on USPS.com and print out the tracking history. So question two is superfluous because sending certified and trackable mail is sufficient. Also, if the scenario was different, it was a personal income tax return, the statute of limitations would be the same. So that's not really an issue. I mean, the issue that I see here that's not really being addressed is when was the extension requested? Because it seems what the reason that the return was determined to be late wasn't because it was late filed per the extension date, but because the extension was untimely requested, and so there was no extension, so it was due back in April, or in this case, March, and that's the reason. So when you, not only when you're filing your return, but also if you're filing a request for an extension by paper, I would also send it a certified mail with a tracking number so that you can prove that they timely received the extension request. And we've litigated this before, and it's not sufficient for the taxpayer to say that they mailed it. You really do need proof of mailing. And having certified mail receipt is enough. You don't need a return receipt, both, you know, one of those green postcards. You don't need to go to that level to establish that you timely mailed something.
All right, Cliff, hopefully that answers your question there. Moving on to the next member, this is Rebecca. Rebecca's an EA and is asking, a CPA buddy of mine told me that a taxpayer cannot discharge a tax liability if the IRS assesses the taxes by preparing an SFR. Is this true? If so, can we prepare and file a return to replace the SFR and then file for BK?
Yeah, so this, the answer to this is a little bit tricky because although bankruptcy court is federal court and bankruptcy rules are federal rules, different circuits interpret the bankruptcy code differently. And like, for instance, here in California, we have the Ninth Circuit, and other circuits apply it differently than the Ninth Circuit does. So in some circuits, once the IRS has assessed the taxes by preparing an SFR, then filing your own return would have no effect and the tax would remain non-dischargeable because the taxpayer did not file a return. In some circuits, it's even more extreme and a late filed return is not dischargeable. So even if no SFR was prepared by the IRS, even if a return was filed one day late, it's not considered a valid return, and so it's not dischargeable. In California and some other circuits, if you file an SFR, if the IRS files an SFR and then you file a return after the SFR and then wait 2 years after you've filed the return, it may be dischargeable. There's a case in Ray Beard, and it's called the Beard test. And It goes through four analyses to determine whether or not the taxpayer filed the return after the SFR in good faith, or whether it was just a ploy to wait the 2 years and file bankruptcy, in which case the court would determine that the return was filed in bad faith and not dischargeable. But at least you have a chance to give a reason why you filed the return after the SFR. I guess one good reason would be if you filed a return and you owed more money on your filed return than you did on the SFR. You could say, I just wanted to be, you know, upfront, and I actually owed more than the SFR said. So it really depends where you live, what circuit you're in, and the circumstances of your particular case and the reason why you filed a return after an SFR.
All right, Rebecca, hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to Henry. Henry is an EA, and actually Henry posed a question that I just saw that Ramon online also posed, which is a very similar question. So you get to answer two for one here, Norman. Question is, what happens when the 10-year statute of limitation is nearing the end? Do we have to notify the IRS? Will automatic payments stop being drafted?
Okay, so no, you don't need to notify the IRS. The IRS supposedly has it set up on their computer system. And I've even seen a letter that taxpayers have received saying the statute of limitations is coming up in a few months. And if you want to make voluntary payments, you can. But after the statute expires, the tax will be uncollectible. So you don't need to notify the IRS. And if you have an installment agreement, let's say a direct debit where payments are automatically being deducted from your savings account or checking account, those should automatically stop at the 10 years. But remember, it's 10 years from the date of assessment. So for instance, for 2017, some taxpayers think that, okay, 10 years would be 2027. But the 2017 return was due either April or October of 2018. And then once they received it, it might take them a month or two to actually assess it. So 2017 return, the 10-year statute would probably expire sometime in May or November of 2028. So remember, it's 10 years from the date of assessment.
Okay, moving on to Michelle. Michelle is a CPA asking, if the client has come to me with a notice of intent to levy already issued, but I believe the returns that caused the liability were completed incorrectly, will entering my client into an installment agreement cause the tax liability to be fixed and agreed, or can it later be argued and amended?
No, entering into an installment agreement won't lock in the original return. And I think it's a good idea because unless the amended return is going to show no tax liability at all, then at least by making the installment agreements based on the original return, you're going to lower the liability. You're going to save penalties and interest. And when the amended return gets posted and processed, then the new amount, that those installment payments will be applied to the new amount owed, which I assume is going to be less. So go ahead and make the installment payments. That will keep you from enforced collection and save you from any levies. And you can still apply it to the amount on the new return.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Hopefully that answers your question, Michelle. Moving on to the next member here. This is Maria. Maria is a VIP member and is asking, under what circumstances does the IRS award innocent spouse relief? I have a client going through a divorce and just found out She and her soon-to-be ex were audited and assessed over $200,000 in taxes, for which she had no idea what was going on. Her husband was the primary person handling the preparation of the returns.
So innocent spouse relief is called equitable relief because the IRS takes all these factors and weighs them and then determines which prevails, whether the innocent spouse should be forgiven the debt or not. It has to be established that it's an undue hardship. So when you say going through a divorce, the kinds of things they would look at is, do husband and wife still live together, or do they live separately? So they filed divorce papers. Are they legally separated? And what's the wife, who's, I guess, the one trying to establish innocent spouse, what's her financial condition? Is she receiving spousal support or alimony from these ex-husband, and in what amount? And is it more than necessary to meet IRS standards? And is she filing her return separate now? And all those kinds of questions. So it's pretty a fact-intensive review. And what I think it mostly comes down to is part of the innocent spouse analysis is the financial condition of the spouse seeking innocent spouse relief. And so you really have to look at the income and expenses of the innocent spouse and determine whether or not the tax would be an undue burden on them or not. You know, it could be that the wife has her own source of income and is actually better prepared to pay the tax than the husband, even though, you know, it was the husband's sole proprietorship or whatever that ended up in the tax audit and the tax issue. So you really need to do an analysis, complete the innocent spouse relief request, and pay special attention to the income and expense chart that's towards the end of the application, and also on page 2 on the questions of whether they're still married, when was the divorce filed, are they legally separated, all those kinds of questions. So it's really, to answer your question, it's a balancing act. Maybe they have 5 criteria, and I've seen it where it's been 3-2. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but they really do look at it that way, like which criteria favor innocent spouse and which ones don't. And so you really have to weigh them and see which side is heavier.
Thank you, Norman. And just so everyone knows, these types of cases are not that uncommon. We encounter these cases, at least 2 new cases a month dealing with innocent spouse. So it is not that uncommon, and it behooves everyone on there to get familiar with how to get this done to be able to maximize the results for your clients. All right, moving on to the last member question here. This is coming from Jay. Jay is asking, do the payment periods for installment agreements max out at 7 years, or can they go longer? Should a client pay off the state taxes due or try to negotiate a payment plan along with negotiating the IRS?
Okay, so first of all, the 7-year installment agreement, that's the streamline. So they look at 7 years. That's the long. 7 years is the long streamlined if you owe between 50 and 100,000.
If you owe 50 and below, 84 is the 50 and above.
7 years is 84 months.
I apologize, you're right.
84 months is if you owe between 50 and 100,000. If you owe below 50,000, it's 72 months, which is 6 years. But the statute for collection is 10. So if you're not doing a streamlined installment agreement, If you're just doing an installment agreement based on a 433F, rather than, let's say, a 9465, then that installment agreement is going to stay in effect until the tax is paid off in full, and that is going to be either on the 10-year statute for collection or the payment's been paid in full. But 7 years is not a max. It's just a max for streamline. It's called an extended installment agreement, and it's extended to 7 years for those owing more than $50,000 but less than $100,000. And then the second part is, should a client pay off the state taxes, do or try to negotiate a payment plan? I'm not sure what state, but here in California, we would say, yeah, you should try to do installment agreements with both, because you can use the monthly payment amount of one to lower the disposable monthly income and expense for the other. So you'd be better off an installment agreement than paying it off in full, because you'd be lowering your monthly disposable income and lowering your installment payment amount. Unless it was streamlined, then it really wouldn't matter. But if you're basing it on ability to pay rather than streamlined criteria, then I would try to do an installment agreement for both state and federal at the same time.
Right, and also states usually are longer in collection statutes, but also have shorter collection periods, which makes the payment higher.
Right, like for here, for instance, in California, they really want to be paid within 3 years. You can stretch it to five, but they're going to look at your financial information sometime within that period. And so it's really a shorter payment period, where IRS, you can stretch it out to the statute. And here in California, the statute's 20 years, but they still want to be paid off sooner. So when you're negotiating an installment agreement, be sure to have something from the other taxing agency to show how much you owe. And if you already have an installment agreement, to show how much your payment plan is. Because once that payment plan, for instance, with the state is paid off, then you would have increased disposable income, and the IRS could set it up where your payment to the IRS would go up when your payment to the FTB stops. So you need to have all that information available.
All right, Jake, hopefully that takes care of the question you had there. Moving on to Charles. So just as a reminder, the following questions are from non-members. I will give you a quick commercial on the membership here in a minute or two, but I, for those of you on the line, we will be opening it up. If you want to start submitting your questions online or entering your name, I am going to open it up a little bit later for those of you on board. And thank you for those who have already submitted their questions. And Ramon, you were one of the lucky ones that got answered right away. But keep sending those questions in, and we'll be able to address those. So Charles is asking, I submitted an individual income tax offer over a year ago, and I've been going back and forth with the offer specialist about expenses on a 1065 for a business that was owned by the client last year, but he sold it this year. Looks like the specialist is disallowing some of the expenses, therefore increasing the client's personal income and then determining he could full pay the tax liability and declining the offer. Have you seen this before? Can I appeal the decision? How can the offer specialist disallow expenses on a 1065 return?
Okay, so question one, have you seen this before? Yes. Also in S-Corps, and I think even C-Corps, where they're looking at the expenses, and if the expenses seem to be unreasonable, then they're applying it to increase the income of the taxpayer. And can you appeal the decision? Yes, and we have, under a very similar circumstance where pretty similar thing happened. And how can the offer specialist disallow expenses on a 1065 return? They can, and they do. But you just need, now in this case, because he sold the business, I'm not sure how that's going to affect the offer, because remember, an offer isn't based on the taxpayer's current financial situation. It's the IRS looking at the current financial situation and extrapolating for years down the road to see what the taxpayer's ability to pay the tax is long term. So if this business is now, it's been sold, and I'm not sure how that's going to affect the taxpayer's ability to pay. And I'm not sure it's something that I would want to, an argument I would want to bring up. So I'd have to look and see how the sale of that business affects the taxpayer's ability to pay, and what happened to the, and did the taxpayer receive some kind of lump sum from the sale, or is the taxpayer getting periodic payments for the sale? So all those kinds of questions would have effect on the offer. But to answer the question simply, yes, we've seen it before. And if you disagree with the offer specialist's decision, you can appeal it. And I suggest that you do. And it's really important that you timely appeal it, or otherwise you lose that appeal right.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. And again, for those of you who are new to this call, we do offer a VIP membership that allows you some consultation time. So cases such as this that require a little extra attention, you're unsure of how to go about resolving this issue, how to appeal a decision procedurally, what to do to carry this particular case to the next phase, we can help you here. We can set up consultation time with Norman or any of our other professionals depending on your circumstances. So I do want to take this time now to just very briefly mention our Ultimate Membership Package. As I mention every single month, we do offer a free trial for those of you who are attending today's call. This free trial gives you 60 days to try out the membership benefits, which include consultation hours, access to videos on demand. You get access to our comprehensive library with that includes a lot of white papers on different subject matters. You get e-learning courses. You get free webinars and discounts on other stuff that we sell online. So if this is something that you're interested in, if you really want to be able to grow your practice, you want to take resolution on and are unsure because you don't know if you have the experience, don't worry about that. Use us as your crutch. We're here to help you resolve any issue, here to support you. Go ahead and give the trial a try, and we'll be able to help you with any particular case. I'm going to be pushing the link to the free trial here for everyone to attend. So just click on it, go ahead and sign up, and let us know how we can help you. Okay, moving on to the next question here, Norman. This is coming from Gardner. Gardner's asking, I just took one of your webinars and heard you speak on in-business offers and compromise. Can you explain how this would work for a company with payroll tax problems? The company still has not been able to make their estimated tax payments for this year and continue to struggle. I want to be able to get them clear of their past liabilities so that they don't go under.
Okay, so for an in-business offer and compromise, the first requirement is current compliance. And that means that they're not going to incur any further payroll tax liability. So when you say that the company's been unable to make their estimated payments, I'm not sure if you're referring to federal tax deposits. And by that, I mean the federal tax deposits that are due per payroll. So that depending on when your payroll is and how many employees you have and how much payroll you have, you need to make federal tax deposit usually the following week from when the payroll occur. So if they're not making federal tax deposits, then they're not in compliance, and they won't qualify. There also has to be some kind of change circumstance. So usually the company is downsized, so they have less business and less employees now than they did before. And so you're going to make an offer that's going to be paid off periodically based on current financial situation, not the past situation that created the tax liability in the first place. So I think that, again, the number one most important thing is that the company is in current compliance and that they're going to remain in compliance during the periodic payment part of the offer. And if they can do all that, then they can get through this and the offer will be accepted and the payroll tax will be paid off at a reduced amount. So again, just make sure that they're making all federal tax deposits. And also remember that there's a stiff penalty for making federal tax deposits late.
All right, yes, payroll tax problems are definitely cumbersome and get very expensive for the businesses. So let us know if we can help you there, Gardner. Moving on to Camille. Camille is asking, can trust fund taxes be discharged in bankruptcy?
So unfortunately not. So when you're saying trust fund taxes, I think you're referring to the trust fund recovery penalty, which would be assessed against an individual considered a responsible person of a company that is, has payroll tax liability. So if they're filing a Chapter 7, which is a liquidation, then those trust fund recovery penalties are considered to be a priority tax and non-dischargeable in a Chapter 7 liquidation. If you're talking about a Chapter 13 reorganization, again, it's a priority tax, so it can't be discharged for less than 100%. So in a Chapter 13, the Chapter 13 plan would have to provide for full payment of the trust fund recovery penalty over the 60-month plan. And the advantage is it doesn't, the unsecured portion doesn't incur interest. So you'd be saving interest and penalties would cease to exist. So you can pay it off in a Chapter 13 plan, but the plan has to provide for full payment of all priority debt. And a trust fund recovery penalty is a priority debt.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to Jeremy. Jeremy is asking, I have a question regarding statute of limitations. My client didn't file his 2006 tax return. The IRS assessed taxes on 411 of 11 based on 1099s filed as he is self-employed. I filed his return on September of 2016 since the IRS didn't account for his business expenses. This reduced tax and penalties by over 50%. Does a 10-year statute of limitation expire on 411 of 21, which is the original IRS assessment, or on 912 of 26, which is the date of the return filed?
So each assessment has its own statute of limitations, and that 10-year statute is 10 years from the date of that assessment. So when you filed his return in 2016, then and again, just to be sure that you understand, the 10-year statute does not expire 10 years from the date that the return was filed, but 10 years from the date that the tax was assessed. So he filed the return on 9/12/2016. And you're saying that it's going to, and you're asking if it's going to be, statute of limitations are going to expire on 9/12/2026, the date that the return filed. The answer is no, because it's not based on the date of the filed return. It's based on the date that the return was assessed. But yes, the assessment based on that return that was filed in 2016 is going to have its own 10-year statute of limitations, and so it's going to go until the assessment date sometime in 2026.
All right. Thank you, Norman. The statute of limitations is always a hot topic, so we want to make sure that we're very clear on that. Moving on to Shakarat. Shakarat is a CPA from Texas, and I'll explain why that's relevant here in a minute. But Shakarat's question is income of non-liable spouse considered for determining collection potential in installment agreement or offering compromise? And can a prenup help prevent non-liable spouse income and assets from being considered in a community property state?
Okay, so it depends on which state the taxpayers live in. So if you're talking about a community property state like California.
And Texas, because Texas is a community.
And Texas. Mm-hmm. Then the IRS can go after the income, but not necessarily the assets of the non-liable spouse. So if the non-liable spouse owned property prior to marriage, that's their sole and separate property, as not subject to the liable spouse collection. But income, for instance, is community property because it's earned during marriage. And so the non-liable spouse's income is can be levied. Now, the difference is some states are different. Some states are 50%, where the IRS can only levy 50% of the non-liable spouse's community property. And other states like California is 100%, where the IRS can levy 100% of the non-liable spouse's community income. And that's pretty harsh. And so if you're going to marry somebody, if you live in a community property state and you're going to marry somebody that owes taxes, get a prenup. And otherwise, it's susceptible to levy, because even though IRS is a federal agency and it's following federal law for collection purposes, it follows state law. So IRS collections is affected by the state in which the taxpayers live, and the IRS has to follow that state's collection laws. And so in California, they can pretty much go after all of the non-liable spouse's income.
All right, Shakarat, there you go. Hopefully that answered your question. Moving on to John. John is asking, my client was self-employed, failed to pay several years in income and payroll taxes. He has no assets to speak of. Lien is already in place, and he is now an employee. Revenue officer is involved, and she issued a summons to appear at her office. We're not going to go and believe the client may qualify for currently non-collectible status until we can file an offer. Other than the RO's continued enforced collection activity, are there any dire consequences for simply not showing up?
In a word, yes. I don't understand why in the world you would ignore an IRS summons if you believe the taxpayer is either currently non-collectible or you're going to be submitting an offer. If you ignore a summons, the IRS can get the assistant U.S. attorney involved, and a criminal case can be brought against the taxpayer for ignoring that summons. So first of all, I would not ignore the summons. Secondly, a lien's already in place, but he's an employee. So what would stop the IRS revenue officer from issuing a levy of his wages? So now, instead of whatever he's taking home, he's going to take home minimum wage, because that's what an IRS wage levy is. They get you to keep only enough to qualify for minimum wage, and anything over that, they can take regardless of how much that is. So a person making, you know, $100,000 a month is going to take home the same amount as a person taking home, you know, $2,000. So because minimum wage is about $10 an hour, so it's about $400 a week. So anything over that is susceptible to IRS wage levy. So I would not ignore the summons. I would not fail to appear. And I would have, she's probably asking for a 433A. I would have bring that and show that the taxpayer is uncollectible, or be prepared to submit an offer, because an offer does stop collection, but that offer has to be submitted, and has to be submitted in good faith. So I think ignoring the revenue officer summons is a big, big mistake, and I don't know why a professional would recommend that a taxpayer ignore summons. I can't understand that at all.
All right, John, call us if you have any questions about what to expect when meeting this revenue officer.
Because even if they're levy, even if they were levy proof, they're still now opening themselves up to possible criminal acts. So why would you do that?
All right, thank you, Norman. Moving on to Elijah. Elijah is asking, a client came to me after the 90-day letter expired for an audit and the IRS disallowed most of their expenses. At this point, is it better to request a review of the proposed adjustments to the group manager or to fast-track mediation services?
Neither. So what they're referring to by the 90-day letter is, along with the notice of deficiency, is a 90-day letter that says that they have 90 days from the date of the notice of deficiency to file a petition in U.S. tax court. So if that 90 days has expired, then they can't file the petition in tax court, because U.S. tax court wouldn't have jurisdiction to hear the case, because it'd be late filed. My preferred method of attacking it and basically getting a audit reconsideration is to submit an offer in compromise doubt as to liability. So where most offers are doubt as to collectability, a doubt as to liability would be why you feel that the audit is incorrect and that the taxpayer doesn't owe as much as the audit says it does. And you would submit the offer doubt as to liability. There's no fee involved. There's no money that you have to submit with the offer like you do when it's doubt as to collectability. And basically what it does is it gets reviewed by an auditor in the appeals office. And so basically you're getting another bite of the apple, and you're getting somebody to look at the audit. But you better have some documentation for the disallowed expenses that you didn't show the original auditor. Checks, invoices, usually for any expense. First, the expense has to be necessary. Then it has to be reasonable. And then it has to be provable. And provable means that you have an invoice and that you have a canceled check showing that the invoice has been paid. So if you have this stuff, but you, for some reason, didn't show it to the auditor, then you would include that in the offer doubt as to liability, and somebody would look at it, and you'd have the ability to to have that audit reconsidered.
All right, Elijah, good luck with that. And again, you can use us to help you if you need or have further questions. Moving on to Diana. Diana is asking, I have a client who shut down their LLC, but owes 4 years of 941 and 940 taxes. This goes back to 14 through 17. They may be a good candidate for an offer. Tax fund recovery penalty has not been assessed yet, but I'm sure it's coming. The owners are thinking of establishing a similar business at a new location. I'm sure there are some issues with doing this, but I'm not sure if the IRS will notice. Should I submit an OIC now or wait for the trust fund recovery penalty? What are the chances they will notice the other business? Any suggestions are appreciated.
Okay, so I see a couple issues here. First of all, if they establish a similar business, they risk what's called successor liability, which means that the IRS looks at the new company and says, basically, it's the old company with a new name and a new location, but basically, it's the same company doing the same business. And so they're going to assess the liability against the new company. And that's called successor liability. So it's not necessarily going to work by closing the old business and opening up a new one that basically the same business. The other thing is, yeah, why would you submit an offer? And since the LLC is shut down, I imagine the offer you're talking about is for the taxpayer. So why would you submit an offer without having the trust fund penalty assessed first? Because you can't include an offer in on assessed liability. So yeah, you would want to wait until it's assessed. And even then, what the procedure is, first you get a notice of proposed assessment of the trust fund recovery penalty, which gives you 60 days to appeal it. If you don't appeal it, it becomes final after 60 days. Or you could just sign off on it and waive your appeal. But in any case, you would want to wait until that not only was the trust fund recovery penalty assessed, but that assessment becomes final before submitting an offer. And what are the chances that they'll notice the other business? They'll notice. You know, they may get a new EIN or whatever, but there may be like tie-ins with the social security number for bank accounts or loans or something else. So I would not count on them not noticing. So I would wait until that trust fund becomes, the assessment becomes final before submitting an offer.
All right, guys. So now I'm going to move on to questions that have been submitted directly online. A lot of you have been responding, so I want to make sure that we get to the majority of you guys. So online, we have Michael. Michael's asking, I know that when you submit an OIC, the IRS stops collections. Does that also mean that if you file a return with the refund due, that the IRS will issue that refund to the taxpayer?
Yeah, so any, like, refunds that are pending while the offer is pending, when the offer is accepted, they seize that refund. And the reason is because that offer was analyzed based on income and expenses of the taxpayer and equity and assets. And so that refund was an asset at the time that the offer was submitted. And so there, that asset would be figured in to the offer. So yeah, they would seize that year's refund. But let's say next year's refund, they would be able to keep. But yeah, that refund would go to the offer.
All right, Michael, hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to Sarah. Sarah is asking, IRS has made adjustments to the taxpayer's return and the taxpayer owes money to the IRS. The taxpayer also will owe money to FTB. Do you have any general guidelines regarding how to coordinate handling of the tax resolution between federal and FTB? Do you finish IRS first and then handle the state, or do you handle both at the same time?
Okay, so one thing is, if the IRS made adjustments to the return, then the IRS sends a copy of those adjustments to the franchise tax board, and then the franchise tax board assesses based on the IRS adjustments. So there may be a time where they owe the IRS but not the FTB. So at that point, you might want to get the IRS installment agreement in place. And then when it comes to the FTB, you can use that IRS monthly payment for that. Is it an offer or an installment agreement?
Looks like it's an installment agreement.
Yeah, so the installment agreement for the FTB would allow that payment to the IRS, and so it would lower the taxpayer's disposable income and and lower the amount of the installment agreement necessary for the FTB. So, I mean, I think the best way to handle it is to get the installment agreement first on whichever taxing agency is being more aggressive or is further down the collection route. So if it's based on an IRS assessment, I would think that the IRS is collecting, could be collecting before the FTB even assesses. So I wouldn't necessarily wait. I would set up that installment agreement and then use it for the FTB negotiations.
And she did come online and say it is for an installment agreement. Thank you, Sarah, for that. Hopefully that answers your question. I'm going to go ahead and ask another question from online here. This is from Raj. Raj is asking, taxpayer is married with two kids under 18, prepare returns for 14 to 17, and owes around $200,000 in taxes. No real estate or major assets, but makes around $250,000 annually. What is the best resolution payment plan for him?
So he's probably with that. So the thing is, when you have when you owe a large amount of taxes and you have what I would consider to be a large income, they're only going to allow you, you know, certain reasonable and necessary expenses within the standards. So if his expenses are way above the standard, the best you could do is to invoke the one-year rule. And the one-year rule, which they won't tell you, but you need to know, is that the taxpayer has a year to get their expenses in line with the standards. So, for instance, if they have a very high mortgage payment or they have very high car payments or whatever, for somebody making that kind of money, then you can have an installment agreement where the first year the payments will be based on the actual expenses. And then after that, the payment will be based on standard expenses. And during that time, you could use that to adjust your expenses, or you could submit new financials after a year to show that there are other expenses that are reasonable and necessary that would lower their disposable income. For instance, medical expenses have no limit as long as you have proof. So some expenses aren't subject to standards, but housing is, and transportation is. And so I think the best you could do is do the financials and be prepared to get an installment agreement with a lower amount for a year and then have that amount go up after a year.
All right, Raj, hopefully that helps you there. It's no easy answer there, but it really depends on their financials and the standards of where they live. Okay, next question here online. Thank you all for submitting those, by the way. We do have a lot to get through here, so let me go ahead and just read it quickly. This is from Heather. Heather's asking, tax client has been delinquent in paying taxes for over 5 years and owes approximately $120,000. He has now lost his job and is living off of unemployment. I want to submit an offer, but client just informed me that there is an old retirement account valued at about $90,000. Will the IRS want him to liquidate? Client is 63 years old and will depend on that money when he retires.
Okay, so the thing is, first of all, when you submit an offer because the taxpayer is currently unemployed, it doesn't really help because they're not looking at necessarily the current situation. So, for instance, if the taxpayer was a highly paid professional and lost their job for whatever reason, but is seeking employment somewhere else, and soon they'll be making their old money again, then that offer's not going to work. If you're saying he's unemployed, lost his job, and is never going to work again, then that's something else. And so that's the first thing to consider. And then secondly is the retirement account. If it's going to be necessary for his retirement, and that's based, you could do an offer based on effective administration. Effective administration means even though a taxpayer has assets that could be liquidated to pay the offer, it would be an undue hardship to force the taxpayer to do that. So, for instance, one example would be if the taxpayer lives in a house that's fully paid for and has equity, and you're going to submit an offer, but you don't want the IRS to force the taxpayer to sell the house, to liquidate it, and pay the equity to the IRS, then effective administration is saying the taxpayer is only living on Social Security and he's just making ends meet as it is with, you know, property taxes and home insurance and all his other expenses. And if he sold the house and all the money went to the IRS, then he'd have to find someplace to live. And there's no place that he could rent that would allow him to live because that rent would eat up all his Social Security. So they would allow him to live in his house and accept the offer, even though he's holding onto an asset that would otherwise have a value and be requested to be liquidated. And the same thing's true with the retirement account, that if he needs that retirement account to live on, that where ordinarily it would be liquidated, in this case, they're going to allow him to retain the retirement account because without that retirement account, he couldn't make ends meet. And so it would be an undue hardship and burden for him to liquidate his retirement account and live on only his Social Security. So there is a way of submitting an offer that would allow him to keep the retirement account, but it's based on whether or not it's necessary. And the other, but my bigger concern would be, is he going to be permanently unemployed now, or is he just in between jobs? Because being in between jobs doesn't make you a candidate for an offer.
All right, Norman, I'm going to read this last question. It looks like we did not touch on penalty abatement, so I'm going to pinpoint this one. This is from Reba. I just requested to have several years abated on IRS tax liability for a client totaling $12,000. The IRS rep said the computer told them the client only qualifies for $650. How do they determine what penalties qualify for the first-time penalty abatement?
Yeah, so first-time penalty abatement is based on the prior 3 years having had no other failure to file or failure to pay penalties. So maybe out of the $12,000, there were failure to pay and a failure to file penalty, and they only qualified for abatement of one because they had the other one within the 3 years prior to that return. But the thing is, the computer is on that is notoriously incorrect. And so I would ask them exactly why. Also, when they send you a letter saying we received your request for first-time penalty abatement, but you didn't qualify, they give you a reason why. And they also give you the ability to appeal it. So I would, if they're wrong, I would appeal it. And the final thing is, if they don't qualify first-time penalty abatement, they may still qualify for abatement of the penalty based on reasonable cause. So research reasonable cause as an alternative to first-time penalty abatement.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. And again, all of those who we did not get to, I am keeping your questions and making sure that we address them next time. If it's something that's urgent and needs a response prior to, please consider using your consultation time if you're a member. If you're not a member, sign up for that free trial link that I pushed through to everyone here and use that consultation time again to get your questions answered. This is the end of this month's Tax Resolutions to Practitioners Forum. We will see you here again December 4th. It's after the Thanksgiving break, so I want to be the first to wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk again next month. All the best.
Goodbye.